On Thursday morning, I got to the office early and called my secretary, Wilma. I told her to stay home for a week or so, to let any blowback from punching the ticket of one of Dragna's goons blow over. As far as I was concerned, anyone who opened fire in a restaurant full of diners got what he deserved. Yeah, I slept just fine. No sooner had I hung up than the phone rang. It was Katzenbach's secretary, Isabella, and she was in a fluster about Roger, who had just shown up and was acting squirrely, loading and unloading a big pistol in Katz's waiting room. I said I would get there as soon as I could. When I did arrive, I found Michael and John there, and Roger was passed out on the sofa. Apparently Izzy had slipped him a Mickey in his coffee and sent him off to Lala Land. Roger's cannon had been safely stored away, but it would be a few hours before Roger could come back to the land of the living, and we could get to the bottom of why he was behaving oddly. I noted he had a notebook in his pocket. There was nothing in there to explain his state of mind, but he had tracked down Dr. Winslow's home address from the museum files. The doc had a house in Westminster in Orange County. I thought we needed to make a visit there later in the day as a priority. In the meantime, Michael had caught up with the Pacific Oil man, Peter Willis, on the phone. He was keen to point out that everything was done by the book, in agreement with Winslow and the museum itself. Winslow had worked with Pat O'Malley and Joe Cash, both of whom were advanced engineers, who worked with the archaeologists ahead of any major work, and had been the point guys on the Andaman Islands dig. He also told Katz that at the request of the Indian State Office, Pacific Oil were not proceeding with the drills, as the area is of particular cultural and biological importance. He confirmed that around 50 to 60 pieces came back, including a large statue, a small golden statue, and a pictographic wall in three pieces, 12 foot by 8 foot each. Michael asked about the instance connected with the warehouse 149, and what is described there as being an atmosphere when he'd visited the place. The staff were surly and unhelpful, and the place seemed full of shadows. Michael had also heard back from the lab on the powder found in Roger's jacket. It contained a highly toxic venom from the stonefish, that's a ray that's found in the Indian Ocean, that can cause paralysis and disorientation. While we waited for Roger to recover, John related a strange incident from the previous evening. He'd been followed home by someone in an expensive, sleek and fast coupe, but he never caught sight of who was driving. Michael took a call from Danny Gellett. News that our names were being mentioned on the street, with someone paying serious bucks for information on us all. Roger woke up around noon, and after drinking an undrugged coffee, was able to tell us what was going on with him. It turned out he had awoken in the middle of the night, with his memory of what had happened in the basement of the museum fully restored. He said he, Heaton, and a security guard named Blake had headed down into the reserve section. There they found another guard, Grant, seemingly asleep in a chair, but he couldn't be awakened. The trio then came across an odd-looking Asiatic man. He was wearing a tattered pinstripe jacket and trousers, but was otherwise naked and barefoot. As they approached him, he blew some dust from his hand into their faces, and they were all paralyzed. Roger says they watched as this man dragged the unconscious Grant in front of them and proceeded to cut the top of his head off, pull out his brain, and place it in Roger's hands. He then turned to the elephantine statue and said, "This will not do," in broken English. Blake had a heart attack, and Roger passed out. Later that afternoon, John, Roger, safely reunited with his cannon, of course, and I rolled down to Westminster. It was a classic burb street, detached houses on wide plots. I was a little concerned about attracting attention when we made entry to the house, but as things turned out, I needn't have worried, as the front door was wide open, as were the doors to the garage on the side of the house. There was a pervasive smell of meat, and boiling dry but still cooking, we found a pork joint on the stove. It was a good job we arrived when we did, as the place would probably have gone up in flames within the hour. To say what we found there was odd would be an understatement. Everything in a cupboard or a fridge had been torn out and thrown on the kitchen table. All the packs had been opened, but the contents were organized into little piles. A pile of rice, a pile of lentils, a pile of beans, the butter had been separated, etc. In the living room, we found the TV tube had been taken out of its casement, and the radio had been dismantled. Books were stacked into individual piles by alphabetical title. Roger found a handwritten journal sitting on the sofa, or at least the front part of it. It had been torn in two. Neatly stenciled on the front was the title, H. Winslow, Field Journal, 1948. The rest of the house was in a similar condition. All suits and outfits had been laid out as if someone was doing an inventory in the bedroom. All the liquid care products, perfume, cologne, soap, had been poured into the bath. There was also a heady smell of female perfume in the air. In the middle of rummaging about, we heard someone call at the door. It turned out to be Winslow's next-door neighbor, Marjorie. John turned on the charm. Well, as much as a man can with a face like his. She said that Winslow's daughter, Susan, had left that morning. She seemed to be in a hurry, driving very dangerously. Marge confided that she thought Susan was a pothead. Previous evening, she'd been seen standing out on the street in nothing but her underwear. Marge came close to calling the cops, but didn't want to cause any trouble. She'd also heard strange sounds from around the house during the night, like things were being moved around. Her dog had been behaving strangely since Susan arrived. No appetite, seemed anxious. Susan drove away in the professor's pride and joy, his Packard Super 6. She said Susan was dressed, but was wearing men's clothes, chinos, shirt, boots. We headed back to Katz's office, with Roger, very keen to read the professor's field notes from the Andaman Islands expedition.